Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to The Writer's Block with Jim Christina and Bobby Bell, right here on LA Talk Radio.
It is 8 o'clock. This is LA Talk Radio. It's Thursday evening, and you're listening to The Writer's Block. I am your host, Jim Christina, sitting in the studio with myself. There's nobody here. It's a very big studio, and it's very empty except for me right now. So we're just going to chat for a minute to myself, and then we're going to wait for Henry to call in. Henry Park will be on the phone here in just a few minutes. And I'd like to give a shout-out to Bobby Jean, who is homesick. She let me know today, which is fine, and I hope she feels better, and I just kind of hoping that she was going to let us know who's on her her concert series next Thursday, but she can tell me next week. And let me see, what else is going on here? I wanted to thank Jeannie Loyacono for calling in last week. She was a wonderful, wonderful guest, and thanks to Jeannie and her gracious, gracious writers, she's filled the writer's block slots for the next 3 years. So, no, that's a lie. But the bookie, my wife Jerry, is extremely busy trying to get them all situated and booked in, and we have Henry Park on the phone as we speak. Henry?
Henry? Hello, can you hear me?
I can now.
I can hear you, too.
Oh, goody.
Excellent. Hey. Well, I'm sorry to hear that Bobby Jean is under the weather.
Yeah, she is.
But, yeah. I am delighted to hear that you're going to have the fabulous Johnny Boggs on the show tonight.
He's actually on the line right now. Say hi to Henry, Johnny.
Hey, how you doing? Johnny, can you hear me?
Oh, I didn't link your two calls. No. That's okay.
Well, that's okay. But, in the next few weeks, I'm going to be reviewing his excellent nonfiction book, Billy the Kid, on film 1911 to 2012 in the Roundup.
Oh, you are?
Oh, yeah. It's a wonderful book. Have you read it?
No, I have not. Oh, Johnny's on with you now.
Hello. It's Henry Park. How you doing, Johnny?
Hey, pretty good. Henry, how about you?
Great. I loved Billy the Kid on film. I'm going to be reviewing that in a couple of weeks in the Roundup.
All right. I love it. Thank you.
Great. Well, now, so Jim, shall I tell you what's happening in the Roundup?
I think you should, Henry, but let's preface this by,
sure.
I wanted to thank you for that great shout-out you give us at each of all of your Roundups, even though it is in the left-hand column and it's six-point type.
Oh, I'll try and center it better next
time. No. I'm just messing with you. Yeah, go ahead, Henry. What's coming up?
Okay, well, just for me, I'm very excited. This past weekend, Henry's Western Roundup passed 250,000 hits.
Wow.
So that's just nice to know that somebody's out there. Now, coming up in about 10 days is the Los Angeles Italia Film Festival. Do you know about this event?
I do not.
Well, it's done with the Italian consulate and all sorts of Italian businesses. They hold it at the Chinese Six Theaters in Hollywood, always right before the Oscars, from February 21st through the 27th. It's a week of screenings of new and classic films from Italy and from Italian-American filmmakers. And the fabulous thing is it's all free. All the screenings are free, first come, first served.
Where are they being held again?
It's the Chinese Theater. You know, the big one right next to it is the multiplex, the
right.
Chinese Six. And it's in there.
Okay.
And they have, always have lots of guests, lots of interesting events. They honoring Sylvester Stallone, Leo DiCaprio, and of particular interest to Western nuts, they're honoring Ennio Morricone, the great composer, showing many of the films he scored, including The Current Hateful Eight, The Untouchables, The Mission, Bugsy, Days of Heaven. In fact, my only complaint is Hateful Eight is the only Western they're showing for the whole program.
Really?
But one's better than none. Now, there's a Western that premiered in 2015, Western Religion, about a sinister mix of gamblers who descend on a tent city in Arizona to compete in a high-stakes poker tournament. It's just been released on video on demand through iTunes, Amazon, Vudu, Google Play, and so on. And on March 1st, it comes out on DVD. and I'm not plugging it just because you can see my right hand on the far left of the screen in the first poker game. I'm plugging it because it's actually a lot of fun, an amazing accomplishment on a micro budget. And let's see. Are you familiar with Get TV?
No.
Well, that's one of those new antenna digital channels, and it's also getting to be available on some of the cable and satellite systems. It's from Sony, and they've got lots of good old movies, and Saturdays are Western days. And they do something really unusual. They've been running a lot of Western TV series that only ran for a season or two, so they're very rarely shown. And this coming up soon, I'm not sure if it's this Saturday or the next Saturday, they're adding Cimarron City, which ran in 58, a Gunsmoke-style show with George Montgomery and John Smith, who went on to great fame in Laramie.
I remember
and
that show.
They're continuing to run Man Called Shenandoah, Hondo, Laredo, Nichols, The Tall Man, Whispering Smith, all sorts of stuff that is rarely seen. I'll have the second part of my coverage of the filming of the new spaghetti western, The Price of Death, featuring my interview with one of its stars, Crispian Belfrage. Now, last time I talked to you, I got some ribbing for featuring a book review about a coloring book.
Yes, you did.
I did, and it was deserved, and I'm sure I'm going to get more ribbing this time because I'm reviewing a kid's book that's about a time-traveling golden retriever.
Ooh, good dog
but
to pick.
Seriously, though, it is from the successful Ranger in Time series by Kate Messner, and it's about a dog who finds himself helping a family along the Oregon Trail. And if I have time to write it, I'm going to be reviewing Jane Got a Gun, which is a terrific little Western that's in theaters now and getting absolutely no attention whatsoever.
I saw that on your blog, that it was been released.
Oh, yeah. It's been out for a couple of weeks, and I saw it at the Arclight, and I look up there, and you know they've got Hateful Eight there. Mm-hmm. They've got the, oh, gosh, I'm just going blank on the other one. What's the other huge Western that's out?
The Revenant?
Thank you. I never heard that word before the title. The Revenant and Jane Got a Gun. And, you know, Jane Got a Gun was packing four people in when I went to see it.
Oh, wow.
And it's just, it's so good, and it's going to disappear if people don't find it quick.
Well, it'll be on Netflix.
That's true. I hope it hasn't gotten there yet, but it probably will soon. Anyway, just for anything anyone wants to learn about these things, please check out Henry's Western Roundup at www.henryswesternroundup.blogspot.com.
Wow. Look at you. You got
hey,
it down.
I'm learning.
Well, thanks, Henry. As always,
well,
it's a pleasure.
You. Great to talk to you.
Always
a pleasure. Look forward to the rest of the show.
Okay, good. And we'll be talking.
Great.
Okay, bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
Okay. Target Freight Management, their truckload division, TFM, is a division of Target Freight Management, and quite honestly, the finest truckload company in the United States. If you are looking for a reputable freight company for full truckloads that get to you 100% of the time, call Target Freight TFM Truckload. Call them today, 1-844-653-7789. Tell them you heard it on the writer's block, and they'll have a little something special for you. And if you're an LTL shipper, chances are you're looking for a great company to help you move your freight. Well, look no further. Target Freight Management is and should be your company of choice. Their customized transportation management system is just the ticket to getting your freight moved all the way and the way you want to move it. Call Target Freight Management today. Their number is 888-653-1323 or go to www.targetfmi.com. You won't be sorry you did. And the writer's block is brought to you by Target Freight Management, by Black Dog Publishing in Simi, and by Out West Boutique and Cultural Center in Newhall. And if you want to call in and talk to Mr. Johnny D. Boggs tonight, the number to call is 818-602-4929. That's 818-602-4929. And I, you know what? I went through your website today, and I got to tell you, it's fascinating.
And oh, really?
Yeah, it is. And I'll tell you why it's fascinating. Not only do you have a really great bio, which I'm going to kind of let you go through on your own, but I'm looking at your book page. I count 57 books. Is that right?
That could be right.
Holy crap. When do you sleep?
Well, I'm not sleeping now. So,
no. Well, no, you're not.
I tell people it's called a mortgage, car payment, 13-year-old boy. You know, but I figured as long as people keep asking me to write books, I'm not going to say no.
So. Well, I don't blame you there. I have to be honest. I did read The Lonesome Chisholm Trail.
Oh, wow. That's the first one I ever wrote.
That was the first one that you wrote, and I loved it. Absolutely loved it.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
What a bunch of great characters.
Wow. Just, well, okay. Well, that's nice. I mean, between you, Henry Park saying he's going to give my Billy the Kid movie book a good review, and I can sleep now.
You're bonused right now. Johnny, why don't you tell our audience a little bit about yourself and where you come from and what you used to do and what you do now? And
I grew up in South Carolina. I was born and raised in South Carolina in the swamps of I think that's why I was fascinated with the West, because watching Gunsmoke as a kid or The Virginian or John Wayne or Randolph Scott movies, it was a long, long way from pine forest and mosquitoes and heat and humidity. So I was always fascinated with the American West. Mm-hmm. Majored in journalism at the University of South Carolina. Went to newspaper work. I was worked on the sports copy desk and was a sports reporter mostly. Right out of school, I wound up at the Dallas Times Herald, and I worked there until it folded in 1991, and then I went to the Fort Worth Star-Telegram and worked there until about 1998. I decided that maybe I wanted to write full-time, so as a joke, I came home and told my wife, said, why don't I quit my job, so we'll sell the house, we'll move to Santa Fe, New Mexico, and I said, you work, you find a job, and I'll just stay home and write all the day, and she said, that's a great idea, and sure enough, it has worked out so far.
So your wife works and you don't. No, you write books.
Yeah, pretty much. Well, the interesting thing is she was working for a magazine, and eventually, when mm-hmm. that time we had our son, she decided she wanted to go into real estate. So she went into real estate, and she does that, and I write full time. I mean, there's no inheritance. There's no steady paycheck for either one of us, mm-hmm. and we're living in Santa Fe, but somehow it usually works out okay.
Well,
but I tell people, you know, when I'm speaking at a writer's conference, I say, you know, don't quit your day job, and that's what I was told
right
when I started out, and I didn't listen, but it is a very difficult way to make a living, so it's not for everybody.
Yeah, I get that. I haven't quit my day job. I still work 50 hours a week.
Well, I probably work more than that. So.
Oh, sure you do. This is what I envision your house looking like. You have several rooms lined up against the wall, and in each room is a word processor. And as you go and you write a couple chapters in one book, then you run over and you do another, and then you do another, and you do another. 57 books, Johnny. Think about that.
I can't write two books at the same time.
You know what? I don't think anybody really can. They say they do.
You're probably right. I can understand the people that say they do it. They say, you know, if I get bogged down on this story, I go to the next story and
right.
start working on that, and
right.
it keeps me fresh. And, you know, in a way I do that because I do a lot of magazine freelance work,
mm-hmm.
And that kind of keeps me on my toes, and it also stops you from getting a little, you know, bored with what you're doing or stagnant or thinking mm-hmm. that you're doing the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
So right now I'm writing a novel, and I've got a magazine article I know I have to do on an art museum. That's due probably next week, and I've got something else that I have to work on for a magazine piece.
Mm-hmm.
And then so I'll get those out of the way, and then I come back and start back on the novel again.
Mm-hmm.
So it kind of works out, and it, you know, it's more money. So
sure. Now, what historically, how many words are your novels? What kind of word count do they run?
They will. I mean, they usually run from about 60,000 words mm-hmm. to. I think the longest one I've ever done is 90 or 95,000 words. The movie, I've done two nonfiction movie books, one on Billy the Kid, one on Jesse James,
mm-hmm.
and the Billy the Kid one probably topped 100,000.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Well, there's a lot of information out there.
A lot of Billy the Kid movies.
Yeah. And just a lot of information in general about him, although they say nobody knew anything about him.
That's true.
So
true. And I thought when I went to the movie books, I mean, I was saying, well, you know, why don't I try a movie book? That might be kind of fun. And I was totally wrong. There's just so much research that's required to track down all these movies. And when you're working on, I mean, Henry Parkin can probably verify that. When you start studying the work in progress of a movie and how it got made, it's a miracle any movie ever gets finished.
Oh, absolutely.
With all the problems they have and all the, you know, loopholes you've got to jump through and things like that. I always found the thing more fascinating because the movies I've written about, you know, Jesse James and Billy the Kid, there aren't very good movies about either one of those mm-hmm. subjects. So I had someone that said, well, what's your next movie book? And I said, well, I'd like to do, if I do another movie book, I'd like to be on movies that are actually pretty good. But the interesting part of that was, you know, tracking down some of the backgrounds on some of the actors and the producers and how the movies actually got made. That struck me a lot more fascinating than writing and watching these very bad movies.
I hear you. That's why the Western Channel is sometimes it's good, sometimes it's really bad.
That's very true.
Hey, what? Tell me about your day. Tell me about your writing day and what time you start and how do you go about it?
I get up in the morning, get my son out of bed, and either my wife or I will take him to school. We drop him off. He's got to be at school. The school's only, right now, it's only 2 miles from our house.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a quick drop off, and then I'm back at work. I pour a cup of coffee or make some tea and sit down at the computer. I'm usually at the computer by 8 or 8:30 in the morning. And then I work till I have to pick him up from school at 3, depending on if he's got something going on after school, 3, 4, 5. And then it's back home, and either I finish up working then, or I have to help him with homework, or we have something else we have to do.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a steady job. I mean, I just tell people I've got a day job. It's just a shorter commute than most people have to make. I just walk from the bedroom to my office, which is on the other end of the house, so there's a little bit of exercise there.
Are you a coffee drinker?
You know, I've cut down a lot. I don't know why. I just decided to switch to tea for some reason.
Oh, well, you still use a mug, though, right?
Yeah, I still.
Okay, well, email me your address, and I'll ship you a Writer's Block coffee mug.
Okay, that's a deal.
So, or just send your address to the bookie. She'll give it to me.
Okay.
Yeah, and my wife Jerry is the one who does all our bookings.
Yes.
So she's really done wonderfully for us. I would like to take a few minutes now and talk about your take on the Western genre, Western books, Western theater, Western movies. Where are they going? Do you have a feeling in your heart about where they're going to be?
The genre has picked up a little bit, I think. You're seeing a lot more New York publishers and major houses starting to do more Western fiction. But there's a huge amount of interest in New York houses about Western nonfiction. And I think that started probably with Hampton Sides, Kit Carson book, Blood and Thunder. And certainly when Sam Gwynne was a Pulitzer Prize finalist for his book on Quanah Parker, that certainly skyrocketed a lot of things. So nonfiction, if we're going to encourage anyone to write about the West, I'd say, you know, nonfiction is probably the way to go right now. So, but, you know, people still buy my book sometimes, so that's always a plus. And it's...
Little more than sometimes.
I kind of expand the West a lot. Uh-huh. I mean, when people ask me what's one of the greatest Westerns ever written, I often will say John Steinbeck's The Grapes of Wrath. And they give me a funny look. I said, what are you talking about? And I said, well, it's the last real westward migration. And that's a hugely phenomenal novel.
It is, truly.
Yeah.
It's hard to read, though.
And you know, sometimes I'm sitting, well, I'm working on a novel right now. It's called The Kansas City Cowboys. Excuse me. And it's actually about a baseball team that played in Kansas City in 1886. It was a National League baseball team that where things kind of got Western. And it's not what I'd call your traditional novel. And a lot of times I know my agent and sometimes my editors will be, you know, when they're talking to me and I tell them what I'm writing and they'll say, oh, God, Johnny, just please, please, please put a cowboy in this one. So I kind of try to, you know, when I started out writing, I didn't want to write the same novel over and over again. And I can understand why people do that. And you know, Louis L'Amour had a tremendous successful career doing pretty much the same thing. But I always say, you know, one thing when I picked up a Louis L'Amour novel, I never put it down until I was finished with it. So there was something about the storytelling there that, that kept me interested or kept me reading at least. Even though his vision of the West and my vision of the West are probably polar opposites.
Oh, I mean, me too.
It was a hard place to live, and it wasn't always heroic, and it certainly wasn't a fun place to be often.
Right.
And there was a lot of racism. There was a lot of ugly things happening in that time period.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of what I often focus on. And you've done that. I mean, I read, was it Contraband Cowboys?
You read Contraband Cowboys?
Yeah.
Did you like it?
Yeah, yeah. The ending, I mean, the beginning of the novel, I thought, oh, man, this guy's really sick. I mean, and I can like that because a lot of people read my novels and they say, should we need to start an intervention here? Is there something you need to tell us about?
Well, I don't think that the word contraband has ever been used very often, and a lot of people didn't even know that that's what the black people were called right after during
Civil
War.
Yeah, they were contraband.
Right. And then that's why I gave a little history about contraband and the word contraband and the contraband camps. But see, like you, I'm very 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 into authenticity, and I really 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 like to be authentic in what I do, because I was an avid horseman. I knew all about the horses and saddles, tack, gear, weaponry, all that stuff. So I try to incorporate as much knowledge into each book that I write, and I seem to do okay. I don't know. I don't have very many critics, so. But I'm glad.
Well, they do point out some mistakes if you make a mistake. I know, and it's a different. I mean, when you're writing if you're writing novels in the say 1940s, 1950s, even into the 1960s,
mm-hmm.
it was mostly escapism, and you didn't read it for the historical accuracy.
Right.
You read it for to be entertained.
Right.
And there's something about that. The readers today are a lot more savvy. I mean, they can track down a lot more information, so they know that the trains did not reach Fort Worth, Texas until the 1870s.
Right.
So if you're writing a Civil War novel and you got someone taking the train in 1866 to Fort Worth in 1953, no one really cared. But in 2016, yeah, they care, and they'll call you on and they'll stop reading you if you start screwing up a lot of the history.
That's true. And that's one of the things about Louis L'Amour that I liked his stories. His storylines were always really solid. But I didn't like the fact that all of his protagonists were, 6 feet, square-shouldered, square-jawed, handsome as hell. And never got dirty, never went to the bathroom, never. My guys, were stinky, smelly. They grabbed those medicated papers and head off into the bushes at a moment's notice.
And mine are usually 5'10" and nervous.
Yeah. Well, mine are old. You read Contraband Cowboys. The protagonist is like 60.
So, yeah.
And I have to speak a little bit about the Lonesome Chisholm Trail.
Okay.
What grabbed me about that book was the absolute very first part of it, when the kid is bushwhacked by his buddy from the bar.
Right.
And takes everything that he owns. And I don't remember the names, and I should have written them down, because there's some great characters in that book. They all were good. I don't remember the name of the guy that was the racist that drowned in the river.
You're going to call me on that, because that book was
written. See, you don't remember either.
That's Richard Hamilton, I think.
Yeah, I think you're right. But he was, for lack of a better word, he was a butthead. But but he was still a good cowboy.
Yeah, and actually I was talking to, I was at a writing event or bookseller stuff somewhere, and actually a black reenactor came up to me and mostly did soldier, he's playing Buffalo soldiers usually, mm-hmm. but we started talking, and he had read my books, and he said how much he enjoyed them and what I was doing, because I put a lot of black characters in it. But he was saying how, cattle drives help. You couldn't be a racist on a cattle drive. You could be, and you probably were if you were a white guy.
Right.
But you had to work together. And and you're often working with former slaves and freedmen who were cowboys, and you had to work together to get the job done.
Right.
And that kind of eliminated a lot of the racism, or a lot of the hard, brutal racism on the cattle tribes. And I said, well, that's an interesting theory there, and there's probably some veracity to that. But Richard Hamilton still was a jerk.
Boy, wasn't he. But, you know, like I said, he was a damn good cowboy, so that's made up for his bad attitude.
But the fact that he drowned.
Well, yeah, that too. But they were all good characters, and they were all good, solid characters. And I love the line, and I love, well, the scenario where he meets his girlfriend in Wichita, and she says, "You stink."
You know where I got that? I was off on a camping trip, or maybe it was working cattle or something like that years ago, and I came home. I've been wearing the clothes for the past, you know, 5-6 days, and I came home, and my wife comes to greet me, and she hugs me and starts to kiss me, and then back away and goes, "You stink."
Well, you know, I put the same scenario in one of my books that the Stryker character from Contraband Cowboys.
Uh-huh.
Is shot, and he's been in bed for weeks, and his woman that he kind of like is falling in love with shows up from San Antonio to take care of him, and he'd met her before, and she's sitting there, and she goes, "Well, once again, Mr. Stryker, you smell. It's time to take care of this. You stink."
Well, no, there was no air conditioning.
No.
I mean, a lot of times they're wearing wool, which kind of breathes, I guess, but also itchy. So, people did sting. They sweated. They got hungry. They had to use the bathroom. You know, I mean, people live. And I picked up a lot of that from, you know, David McCullough. I was listening to him give a talk once, and he was reading from a nonfiction book that he said he absolutely loved, and it's about some famous character, maybe inspiring him to write John Adams or whatever. But he says, what I love about this book is it opens with a guy eating. Mm. He's eating, because that's something you never think of, these great figures, these John Adams, George Washington, you know, Wyatt Earp, or Wild Bill Hickok. They actually had to eat.
Right.
And, you know, they did things what humans have to do to survive, and eating is one of them.
Right.
So I always thought that was kind of interesting.
Oh, I was going to ask you. Oh, okay. I read your blurb this morning on Facebook, and I was chuckling over it because it's the writer's block, but there's no such thing. You remember writing that?
not if you work for a daily news.
Right, and I get that. I get that. Now, we've had writers in here, and some of the writers say, "No, I don't get writer's block. I don't think it exists." And there's some that go, "Yeah, I do." And you know, this is what I do to get over it. And others say, well, maybe sometimes, or sometimes I don't get it. And it seems to be such a dichotomy of ideas about writer's block or what it even is.
Right. I come into problems, you know, you realize something's not working.
Right.
And you've got to figure that out. And Max Evans, who's a friend of mine who lives down in Albuquerque, who's 91 years old, he wrote the novel The Rounders, which became the Henry Fonda Glenn Ford movie, and he wrote The High-Low Country, which was a pretty really good, you know, post-World War II Western that came out in, I think, 98 or 99, somewhere around there. But, you know, I go down and have lunch with him a lot. And he says, you know, whenever he gets into a problem, and when he was writing, he said he'd get up and take a walk, you know, and, you know, I can take a walk through some really pretty country out here, just walking around the block. And a lot of times you figure out what you need to do on that mile little stroll that gets you fresh air and gets you away from the computer and it gets you out of the house and makes you actually, you know, do something. And that's how often I will, you know, work out a problem. Or you just keep rewriting and rewriting, and you do the Hemingway thing where you keep rewriting until eventually eventually your editor is waiting on the story and you know you want to hit that deadline.
Right.
And so the editor doesn't get mad at you. And that was something else I learned in newspapers. So I had a magazine editor once call me, and she goes, "Hey, Johnny, you know, we're just, you know, wondering about your story, and, you know, it's due today." And I said, "It's still today." I figured I've got until 11:59 p.m. to file that story. Now, another magazine kind of learned my trick, and they started putting the time on when that story was due. So I couldn't get around that anymore.
Like close a business?
But the main thing, and I say, people say, how are you so successful? And I said, well, it depends on how you define success. But what I do is I turn in a relatively clean copy. It's not always, it's never perfect. It's, sometimes I wouldn't even call it, it might be kind of just borderline good. But it's fairly clean, and it's filed on time.
Right.
And that's something that newspapers trained you to do. And I think that's why editors keep calling me to do stories or books, because they know I'm usually fairly dependable on hitting that deadline.
Mm-hmm. I'm fortunate enough not to have deadlines, so I don't have to worry about that. But we had some writers in here, and Bobby Jean is probably going to call me on this because I know that she remembers it differently, or maybe not. One of the writers we had in here told us about the writer's block, and he got writer's block, and when he got it, he would go back and completely rewrite the entire chapter. I thought, wow, that's a lot of work.
That's a lot of work.
That is a lot, especially if you're at the end and you don't know how to segue to the new chapter.
Yeah. I think the one thing that, people say, and we get this too, do you love writing or do you hate writing? And I always say, I love to have written. But the actual physical part of writing, it's never, I don't really dread coming into the office and closing the door and sitting down, turning on the computer and starting to write. But it's not a fun thing to do. It's never fun for me. It's hard.
It is hard.
It can be frustrating. But I can't think of doing anything else for a living.
I'm going to tell a story on you.
Okay.
You have won the Western Writers of America Silver Spur or the Spur Award six times.
Six times.
Is that a record? Is that a record in WWA?
The record's seven.
Elmer
Kelton won seven, and my theory is that they're never going to let me tie Elmer Kelton, and I certainly wouldn't blame him for that.
Well, I was looking at some of the books that had been nominated and some of the ones that won now. Now, The Lonesome Chisholm Trail was nominated.
No, it was not nominated.
I thought it was.
It got some good reviews, but, it kind of went out. It was the first novel. I mean, no one's going to take you seriously on your first novel. And it wasn't even my first novel. It was the first novel I finished, and it took me like three years to sell it or something like that. Uh-huh. So I had a bunch of books come out before that one actually came out, but that was the first novel I ever finished. This is the struggles of an early, non-established, nobody writer.
Right.
You finish a novel, and then you try to get it sold. No one wants to listen to you. No one wants to talk to you because you've got one book, and maybe they don't even think it's good. It's luck, I think. Mm-hmm. It's winding up on the right desk in front of the right set of eyes at the right time, and maybe it fills a void they need, and that could be all it was. But
yeah, sometimes it is. That's all it is luck.
Yeah. Yeah, I think there's got to be a little bit of degree of talent in there, but I think it's mostly luck, and more importantly, it's persistence.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm getting rejected all the time. I mean, I send the book, you send the query in, and
right.
They say no, and then maybe they ask for three chapters, and if they ask for three chapters, you say, oh, cool, and then you wait, and then they say no, and you just keep going, and you keep plugging away. I did that with short stories.
Uh-huh.
When I was starting out, on short story, I was just trying to get established. By sending to a magazine that's going to pay me to contributors copy. But, and you're getting rejected there a lot. And you just got to say, it's nothing personal. It's strictly a business. And you just keep plugging away.
Sure.
And eventually, if you're persistent enough and you're lucky enough, it happens. It happened for me.
Well,
if it can happen to me, it can happen to anybody. Right?
Well, sure. I think that's where a lot of new writers go wrong, is they give up.
Yeah. Well, my mother always told me that the hard heads run in our family.
Uh-huh.
So I think I had that going for me.
Well, South Carolina boy, you probably did.
Yeah, definitely.
We were just talking to Troy D. Smith. About 2-3 weeks ago, and
uh-huh.
he recently finished a novel he had started writing like I think 30 years ago.
Well, you know, when I started to write, and Troy's a good guy and a really good historian. When I started writing Lonesome Chisholm Trail, I was working for the newspaper, so I'd come home. Maybe I'd work on it a little bit. Maybe I'd find something better to do, book to read, something to cook, a movie to see, a concert to catch. So I wasn't very focused on the novel. And that's why it took 3.5 years to write it and another three and a half to sell it.
Mm-hmm.
But when I was writing it and when I started shopping, I realized no one's going to really be interested in you. Because they won't, no agent, no publisher wants a one-book wonder unless you're Harper Lee. And now you can't even call her a one-book wonder.
No, she finally got another one done.
but they want someone who can actually produce. And for a Western or a genre or, it was a mystery science fiction, if it's a genre, they probably want at least maybe one book a year, maybe one book every 2 years or something like that. So you've got to be able to deliver that. And that's what the first book taught me is that, you can't spend 3.5 years on a book. You've got to be able to do a book in 1 year.
Right, right.
And that's how I started out doing it, and that was my goal. And then it became, okay, we want 2 books a year from you. And for a while, there was even 3 books a year. And you just have to accept that. And it's like a newspaper, You've got the story to cover. You've got 15 inches to file the story.
Right.
And you've got to file the story by 10:15. And you've got to hit your word count, and you've got to hit your deadline, and that's always been my focus.
You come from a good background to do that.
Well, yeah, I mean, newspapers were. I mean, I wouldn't want to be in newspapers now. Don't get me wrong. I mean, in fact, I've got friends when I got out in 1998, and they're still in the newspaper business, and they'll talk to me. Did you know what was coming? Did you know that newspapers were going down to the toilet? Is that why you got out? And it wasn't, but. At the time, it was fantastic training.
Oh, I'm sure.
And I worked for some absolutely wonderful, wonderful people.
We interviewed
jerks.
We interviewed another Troy Smith, a Troy Andrew Smith, and last year, and his book that he had written, and I don't remember the name of it. Oh, Raidersburg Gold. He wrote flat on his back because he had really injured his back. Flat on his back with a legal pad and Bic pens. He hand wrote the entire book upside down. So he said he would write for about 2 hours, which is what the Bic pen could hold, and then he'd throw that away and grab another one and keep going.
They're all methods. I know people who write have to write on manual typewriters still. I know people who do longhand. Most of them, I believe, do like me. They do it on the computer. I know one guy who moved from the computer, but he had to put a program on his keyboard for his computer that made it, when he typed, it sounded like he was typing on a specific brand of manual typewriter.
Oh, is that right?
They're weird. Yeah. I mean, people are weird.
Well, I tried. I bought that program that you can speak and it types your words. I don't remember what it's called.
Yeah.
I can't get it to work right.
Yeah.
I don't know why. I'm just that kind of guy, I guess.
But I can understand you clearly. So.
We're worldwide radio here. when we were talking to Jim Jones, he had nothing but really good things to say about you.
That's funny. He never says anything nice about me to my face. But,
we'll call him up on it because I think we're going to see him in April. I think he's going to be out for the Cowboy Festival. I'm not sure.
Okay. Yeah. Well, Jim's a fantastic guy. Great singer.
Oh, my gosh.
Great musician. Good writer. Funny guy, too. I like hanging out with
him. He's just the quintessential all-around nice guy.
Sure.
Well, then you're not so bad. So, I mean, guys, been friends for a while.
I have moments.
Yeah, well, don't we all? But we have coming up on this next, couple weeks, 2-3 weeks, we have Peter Shirako's wife is going to be on with us next week.
Okay. Uh-huh.
Susan, so that's going to be fun. But where do you come up with your ideas?
Ideas are never a problem. I expect I was doing research on this baseball book that I'm working on right now. And I just was looking at something, and I just saw a name, a title. It was actually a team's name. And I said, wow. And I wrote it down.
Uh-huh.
I said, there's got to be something there. So I've got a list of ideas that's on my computer. It's under a file called Novel Plans or something like that. And and eventually what happens is my agent will call me and say, okay, what do you want to write for next year? And that's when I have to say, okay. Then I have to go to that list and say, which one's ready? And which one's just, like I said, a title? Which one can I write? Which one do I want to write? And I think sometimes, if this is the last book I ever write, is that going to be okay with me?
Yeah, I think that too.
Yeah. So yeah, I have too many ideas, and I'm, what, 50, just turned 54. I have too many ideas on that list that I'll never get to them. Mm-hmm. Even if I live another 50 years, I'll probably never get to them all.
Well, I want to see you do another 57 books. That's what I want. Do you write with outlines?
Usually, yes. Usually I do. I did an experiment years ago. It was a novel called, it was a young adult novel, pretty much called Doubtful Canyon. And a lot of times what I do, and this is something, I think Wynn Blevins, who's a writer I know, and unfortunately he's a St. Louis Cardinals fan, so, but we won't get into that. But Wynn was telling me that sometimes he would start a novel. Mm-hmm. Just so he could get a feel for the characters and the place and everything like that, and then he'd have to go back and do an outline for the rest of the book. So I did that a couple times, but usually I have an outline, a loose outline, that I know that I can go around and change it and make some things, correct some mm-hmm. things that the outline's mm-hmm. not right about. Years ago, I started a novel called Doubtful Canyon, and it was a young adult novel, and I started writing it, and I said, well, you know, I'll just start writing it. And then when I get to the stopping place, I'll stop and do the rest of the outline. And then I kept thinking, wait a minute, let me try this as an experiment and see if I can actually write a novel without doing it out, following an outline. And I finished it without an outline. And I said, okay. And it won a Spur Award. And I said, well, hey, maybe there's something there.
There it is.
But, I mean, it works for different people. And I've done some very complicated novels that I could not come even anywhere close without an outline. Mm-hmm. But the problem with an outline, if you write from an outline, is if it gets predictable, mm-hmm. Because you're following this rigid outline, then it's going to be predictable book for the reader, and you're going to lose the reader.
Right.
And so I always make it a loose outline. And the problem, if you're writing without an outline, I think they call it writing for discovery. You start to sit down and start writing, and you don't know where it's going to go. Well, you can go off, and I've read books about this, where you go off on these wild tangents that have nothing to do with the story. And you lose a reader that way, too. So you have to kind of in command, whether you're writing from an outline or whether you're writing for discovery. You have to be in command and know the story and be able to stop that when you start going off, or be able to stop and fix that outline so it's not so rigid and it's not so predictable.
Right. Have you written any series?
The first novel I ever had published was called Hannah and the Horseman, and I wrote it as a standalone, and it's for Avalon. They're out of business now, but they wrote, you know, very short, 40,000-word novels that had no profanity, no sex, no graphic violence, anything like that. That's for mostly a library market. But I wrote the novel, and they accepted it, and it was the first novel I ever had published, and the editor said, we want you to turn this into a series. And I said, oh, okay. That means you want another book. So I wrote a series for, that went about seven, and then I'd moved on to another publisher. Mm-hmm. And I did a novel that I wasn't sure about. It's kind of a period mystery. It's Tony Hillerman, but only in the 1880s, and it's about the Comanches instead of the Navajo. But mm-hmm. it was a period mystery about a Comanche Indian who comes home from the Carlisle boarding school and becomes part of the agency police force, and he has to solve mysteries. And I wrote it, and it kind of did well, and my agent said, you need to turn this into a series. And I did. I guess I'm up to four, and they might want another. But what happens for me with a series is after about the third, fourth book, I want to just take all the characters and crush them to death with a herd of stampeding buffalo.
You know, my sister-in-law reads all my books, and she's always calling. She goes, you killed him off. you killed off my favorite character. I said, no, I didn't. The ghost did. No, you wrote him. You know, and I'm sure, I don't know if you believe this or not, but my theory is that some characters serve a purpose in one or two books.
Sure.
And then they're really no longer needed because now you have something else to fill that void.
Right.
So you somehow kill them off. A horse rolls over on them, or, you know, they drown in a river or whatever. But people get to like these guys. I wrote a character named Jolly Goodman, and everybody loved him because he was this vile, stinky, drunken old miner that, you know, long hair, scraggly beard, but he loved the hunter, loved him. I killed him off, you know, and that's, whoa. You'd have thought I robbed the national bank. But I find the characters, if they're a good, solid character, they'll write their own story.
Sure. And I've had that too. I mean, I've been writing a novel, and you know, I did a novel called Camp Ford, and it won a Spur Award. It was a Civil War baseball western. I call it Literary's first Civil War baseball western. It's about a baseball game between Confederate guards and Union POWs in a prison camp in Texas. And I said in Texas, so they call it a western.
Mm-hmm.
But I just kind of looked up on my bookshelf, and I said, I need a name for this character. He was a character, and I thought he'd be a minor character in the novel, even with my outline. And I looked up there, and I just saw a name, a writer's name, and I made it his name. And I figured, okay, he's going to be in here for one or two scenes, and that's it. And he became a fairly major character through the novel. So, I mean, they do take a life on themselves, even if you've got that outline that tells you where the book's going.
Right.
And that's kind of the fun thing about writing. I mean, no matter how you're writing, when you see something kind of take off and then you develop this character instead of the supporting character or even just a bit player, he becomes gets a substantial part, and you kind of like this guy.
Yeah.
Even if you're going to kill him or whatever you're going to do with him, you say, hey, this is kind of cool. I like this guy.
Yeah, well, hey, look, it's been great talking to you. We're going to be running out of time here in about a minute.
I know.
And
well, I enjoyed it. Thanks
so much.
For having
thank me. You so much for coming on with us. It's been a great evening.
Yeah, it has.
And make sure you get your address to the bookie so we can get that coffee mug out to you.
Okay, that's what we need. Great.
Thanks,
one
John.
One more coffee cup. My wife's going to be so happy.
Wait, want me to send her one too?
She'll use mine. Don't worry.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
Thanks again, Johnny.
Thanks,
have a great evening. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye.
And we've been on the air with Johnny Boggs, one of the most prolific Western writers out there right now. 57 books and counting, working on more. Articles, short stories. The guy is just like, wow. Next week on Writer's Block, I hope Bobby will be back in the studio with us next week. I wish I could look over and see her right now, but unfortunately she is still sick. But Susan Schirico will be with us next week. For those of you who don't know, Susan is the wife of Peter Schirico, or Texas Jack Vermillion from Tombstone. And for those of you who have worked with Peter, then you know Susan. And time is coming to a close now, so I thank you all for listening. It's been not a struggle, but it's been kind of weird not having my studio mate in here with me. But we managed to muddle through. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you again next Thursday night.